Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
You know those tiny moments that end up steering everything. I keep coming back to them. If one hinge swings the other way, entire centuries look different. That's the headspace I'm in for this one, trimming a single connection and watching the map rearrange itself.
Then let's pull that thread. Take the axis triangle and erase one corner. Japan sits it out, or, wild thought, tilts toward the Allies. The scaffolding of the Allied grand strategy from 42 on was built for two oceans and two main theaters. Pull the Pacific leg, and the whole plan lists.
The anchor point is September 1940. The Tripartite Pact ties Germany, Italy, and Japan together. If that pact never really coheres, the war doesn't instantly go global in quite the same way. And the knock-on effects in Europe start sooner than people think.
First stop, December 7th, 1941. In this version, it's just a quiet Sunday. No Pearl Harbor, no galvanizing shock.
Which means Franklin D. Roosevelt is still up against a dug-in isolationist mood. He'd been coordinating with London and The Hague and warning Tokyo about grabbing neighboring countries. But that's not the same as getting Americans to back a full-scale European war without a punch to the jaw.
And there's the German side. Historically, Hitler declares war on the United States in solidarity with Japan. A disastrous impulse decision. No attack on America, no declaration from Berlin. So Washington stays, at least on paper, out.
That leaves Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin staring at a long, dark tunnel. No certainty of American troops, no guarantee of American industry at wartime throttle. For Churchill, that's ice in the veins territory.
But the real pivot is in the snow outside Moscow. Can we pause there? Because that's where my version of the timeline flips.
Go on.
By early December 41, the Wehrmacht has run out of speed and warmth. They're frozen, overextended. The Soviets are also reeling, and Stalin's glaring east because the Kwantung Army is sitting in Manchuria. If he thins the Far East, does Japan stab him in the back?
He only moves because of intelligence. Richard Zorga and others saying Tokyo's chasing a southward advance for oil, not a strike at Siberia.
Right. That's the confidence he needs to peel off the winter-trained Siberian divisions and throw them at Moscow. Those troops help make the December 5th counteroffensive possible. Sorry, can you repeat that date? I was scribbling.
December 5. And that push shoves the Germans back hundreds of kilometers.
Okay, now delete Pearl Harbor from the script, but keep Japan neutral and untested. Does Stalin still trust that bet? I don't think he can. He leaves a lot more muscle in the Far East, which means the counterpunch at Moscow is weaker.
So the line freezes. The Germans dig in at the edge of the capital and wait out the cold.
Exactly. A winter on Moscow's doorstep. And that image won't leave my head. The symbolism is awful, but it's also logistics. Those rail lines converge there. If Army Group Center is parked right outside in the spring of 42, the temptation to go for the city, the brainstem, becomes almost irresistible.
Wait.
Oh,
yeah. If they're already there, the 42 plan skews north.
Historically, summer 42 is Operation Blue, south to the Caucasus and Stalingrad for oil. But with a rested front at Moscow's gates, the calculus tilts. The city's both the crown jewel and the switchyard. Hitler loved symbols. This one also strangles movement, if you take it.
So Stalingrad becomes a sideshow, or at least not the main stage. And the grim version is, the spring blow lands on Moscow. Do the Soviets hold?
I've been hedging for 10 minutes. Plainly, In this branch, Moscow likely falls in 42. Not instantly decisive, the Soviet state is more than one city, but it scrambles the tempo and the mythos of the Eastern Front.
Meanwhile, Churchill's in London reading cables about a capital under siege or lost, and the U.S. still officially on the sidelines. Lend-lease keeps flowing, but nowhere near the historical fire hose without a declared war.
Which shoves Britain back into fortress mode. No Germany first, because from Washington's vantage point, it's nobody first. No D-Day in sight. No round-the-clock U.S. bomber streams smashing factories. The Battle of the Atlantic grinds on, with U-boats multiplying, and London clings to lifelines.
I prepped the Siberia-Moscow files hard, and embarrassingly shortchanged North Africa. Can you carry that strand?
Happily. Without American landings in late 42, no Operation Torch. The British Eighth Army is still chasing Erwin Rommel across a continent, but without the hammer blow from Morocco and Algeria. Bernard Montgomery's gains stretch thin. The Axis can keep more troops and aircraft in the desert because they're not firefighting a Pacific catastrophe. Malta stays under the gun. The Suez Canal is menaced, and the Med remains contested. Roll into 1943 with Moscow fallen or strangled, the desert unresolved, and Britain bleeding alone. That's a map edging toward an Axis-favorable equilibrium.
It's the bleak end of a second act. And this is terrible timing. The phrase you used earlier just hit me. Remove the rising sun from the Axis flag. That's going to echo in my head all week.
I'll take that. Now, pivoting east brings us to the question that still stirs arguments. What actually forced Tokyo's hand in 1945?
The neat classroom version says, two cities, two bombs, the emperor yields. But the scholarship muddies that. The firebombing of Tokyo in March 45 killed on the order of 100,000 in one night, and surrender didn't follow. Dozens of cities burned. Still, no capitulation.
So, why would two more annihilated cities be the singular trigger? Enter August 9. The Soviet Union storms into Manchuria. David Glantz makes the scale painfully clear. Over 1 million Red Army troops smashing the Kwantung Army. For Japanese Army leaders, that's the nightmare realized.
Robert Pape's argument slots in neatly. The sea blockade already throttled production, and now the Red Army, the one that chewed up the Wehrmacht, was set to threaten the home islands. The calculus flips from endure to choose your occupier.
Surrendering to the United States held out the possibility of preserving the emperor and some political continuity. Surrendering to the Soviets suggested a very different future. The timing starts to look less like awe before a new weapon and more like a brutal choice between bad outcomes.
And when you zoom back out, the human bill is almost ungraspable. Victor Davis Hanson puts Soviet dead in the tens of millions. Rana Mitter tallies Chinese military losses in the millions, too. The numbers go numb if you stare too long.
Then the borders move. Piotr Eberhardt tracks how the Oder-Neisse line becomes Poland's west, the Curzon line its east. Whole populations uprooted. Peace doesn't just stop the fighting. It redraws where people live.
Out of that wreckage, they try to nail the world together. The United Nations, Bretton Woods. And yet the alliance that beat the Axis frays immediately. Iron Curtain, Greek Civil War. The Cold War walks in before the Ink Prize.
Which loops us back to our hinge. Pull Japan out of the Axis, and you don't get a tidier century. You get a Europe where Moscow might fall, a Mediterranean that won't settle, and a United States that takes longer to commit, if it ever does.
I didn't expect the technical bits, rail hubs, winter kit, shipping corridors, to be the fun part, but here I am, fully invested. And also a little spooked by how easily that one missing Sunday in 1941 could have sent us down a darker 1943.
Same. and I'm still stuck on the quiet terror of a Wehrmacht winter at Moscow's edge. Say it again, not for emphasis, just because the image pins everything down.
The Germans warming their hands within sight of the Kremlin, waiting for spring.
That's the branch I can't stop tracing. And it makes our own timeline feel improbably fragile. Not inevitable, just the one that happened to hold together when so many others could have come apart.
Which is exactly why we keep doing this. To test those hinges and remember how contingent the world really is.